It is Friday, January 29th, and this is VOA's International Edition. I'm Sarah Williams in Washington. Coming up, Republican presidential candidates debate without businessman Donald Trump. Syrian peace talks are set to begin despite confusion over who will participate.
So if only the government is present, then at least the UN can begin the process of finding out what the government's conditions are.
And a prize-winning British poet reflects on her Chinese roots. It's all ahead. Well, beginning with U.S. politics, Republican presidential candidates on Thursday held their last debate before Monday's Iowa caucuses, the first event in which voters actually make their choices for their party's next presidential nominees. International Edition's Steve Norman spoke with VOA national correspondent Jim Malone, who's in Des Moines, Iowa, to cover the caucuses and the debates.
Yes, a Republican debate, minus Donald Trump. That's the big news. Trump held an event of his own just a few minutes away from the auditorium where the debate was held. He, of course, was upset with the moderators on Fox, which is broadcasting the debate. And Trump was doing a benefit for wounded warriors, so he was focused on that. The rivals, interestingly enough, talked about Trump initially. Some made a little bit of fun that he wasn't there, but they pretty much have left him alone after that. I don't know in the end if this is going to hurt Trump or help him or what.
Yeah.
We just, you know, this election cycle has been so unpredictable.
Definitely that. In fact, I heard going into this, some people were saying that CNN, which is a rival to the other cable station, Fox, which is carrying this thing, was going to carry the Trump event, and that they thought that a better judge of the way things might go is comparing the number of viewers to CNN as to the number of viewers of Fox. I guess, who knows?
That's right. Well, I'm sure if it turns out that more people watch the Trump event, you'll hear about that from Donald Trump. One little odd note, two of the lesser contenders, Rick Santorum and Mike Huckabee, appeared with Trump at his event. That was a little interesting. By the way, those are the two men who were the last two winners of the Iowa caucuses in 2012 and 2008.
Let's talk about that, about the significance of Iowa being the first place where voters actually do something officially to decide who'll be the next president.
Yeah, it's evolved over time, Steve, since the mid-1970s, really. Jimmy Carter was one of the first people to make a real effort in Iowa. It helped him get on the map. That's what Iowa is important for. It gets you momentum. It gets your name up there. It gets you off to a big start. The one who really, you know, was made by Iowa in some ways was the current occupant of the White House, Barack Obama.
Indeed. I remember being in Iowa with you a long time ago, but it was when Howard Dean was on the cover of every magazine. Going into Iowa, they said, this man will be the nominee of the Democratic Party. We got out there and we found out that he'd got nowhere near it. It ended up that two others, John Kerry and his running mate, eventually took the state in that case. So I guess we don't know until it's all said and done. Before we leave you, Jim, just want to find out what happens after Iowa. There are more people to make decisions in the country.
Oh, that's for sure. And we go then to the first primary state, New Hampshire. A different electorate, not quite as conservative, not quite as many, say, Christian activists who are active in New Hampshire. That's where the moderate candidates may come to the fore, people like Jeb Bush, Marco Rubio, Chris Christie. So that the test in Iowa is really among two conservatives, Ted Cruz and Donald Trump. When we get to New Hampshire, those more moderate establishment candidates will have their moment to make a play.
And I guess we should say the Democrats are running candidates in these things as well, right?
You know, they sure are, and it's going to be a tight race, and it's really something to watch, the Bernie Sanders-Hillary Clinton race. It's really something here, Steve, with two competitive races at once.
That's VOA national correspondent Jim Malone. He was speaking with International Edition's Steve Norman. In other news, there's confusion over whether Syria's opposition will attend peace talks Friday in Geneva. United Nations officials say they're going ahead with the talks. I spoke with VOA Europe correspondent Luis Ramirez, who describes the complicated situation.
Right, Sarah. There's confusion right up to the last minute before these talks get underway. The last we heard is from the opposition. The Saudi-backed opposition group known as the High Negotiations Council say it will not come to the talks, that it certainly would not come to the talks. That's because its demands on getting the Syrian government to lift the siege and to stop airstrikes on civilians, as those demands have not been met.
But apparently there is a possibility that there might be figures from the opposition still might show up.
It's unclear all the way to the end. Way the UN is doing this is they sent out invitations on Tuesday, would not disclose who it had sent invitations to. We won't know till the very end. For now, the only ones that we have confirmed officially who will be attending will be members of a Syrian government delegation. They are set to sit down with UN officials, with UN mediators. That will mark the start of the talks in the afternoon of Friday.
But if none of the opposition figures attend, how useful can these negotiations be?
That's a great question, Sarah. We have to keep in mind that these are proximity talks. They're not direct negotiations. So even if the opposition did show up, there would be no negotiations between the government and the opposition. That's not what these meetings are about. These meetings are about laying down the groundwork, that is, having the mediators talk to the two parties, figure out what they want, what their conditions are for sitting down to talk, and then sharing them with the other side. So if only the government is present, then at least the UN can begin the process of finding out what the government's conditions are, what it will take for them to sit at the table to eventually come to a table and negotiate face-to-face with the opposition. But face-to-face negotiations were never part of the plan.
What kind of divisions are there within Syria's opposition groups?
Well, it is from the start a very fractured opposition. On the one hand, you have the extremists that include the Islamic State group, the Al-Nusra Front. On the other side, you have the moderate opposition, which is supported some by Turkey, some by the Saudis, some by the West. One of the most visible fractures is that involving the Kurds. Now, Russia wants the Kurdish Syrian party to take part. Turkey said absolutely not. In fact, if the Kurds take part, Turkey threatened to remove its support for the peace process. Eventually, the UN decided that the Kurds would not be invited to attend. So that's just one of many, many fractures in this opposition movement. And that's what makes this so complicated going forward.
VOA Europe correspondent Luis Ramirez. This is VOA.
Here's science in a minute.
Globular star clusters are spherical, tightly bound groupings of hundreds of thousands of stars that usually can be found within a galaxy's periphery. Scientists say that there are several hundreds of these star clusters in our own Milky Way galaxy. Stars in these clusters have long been thought to be some of the oldest in the universe after being formed all at once and around the same time. But now an international team of astronomers may have cast some doubt on this thinking, since they discovered populations of young stars in these groupings. Rather than all of its stars being formed around the same time, the researchers found that the presence of younger stars indicates that there may be several generations of stars that make up the clusters. The astronomers also say they've found evidence that these young stars have developed from gas that flows from outside the cluster instead of internal material cast off by other stars. I'm VOA's Rick Pantaleo.
This is International Edition on the Voice of America. I'm Sarah Williams. Coming up, a British poet wins her country's top prize for poetry. Denmark's parliament passed measures this week aimed at deterring refugees from seeking asylum. This will include confiscating valuables to pay for their stay, despite protests from international human rights organizations. The measures are the latest sign that the Nordic welcome for refugees is waning as large numbers flee war in Africa and the Middle East for a better life in Europe. The jewelry bill is the latest attempt by Denmark's minority center-right government to curb immigration to a country that took in a record 20,000 refugees last year. Under the bill, the refugees could keep possessions amounting to around $1,450. Valuables of special emotional value, such as wedding rings, will be exempt. The Liberal Party government has just 34 out of 179 seats in parliament and depends on the support of rightist parties, including the anti-immigration Danish People's Party, to pass laws. International Edition's Ira Melman spoke with Jakob Ellemann Jensen, a spokesman for the Danish Liberal Party.
We have a fundamental principle. When you live in Denmark, if you're able to pay for your own food, for your own housing, then you should. If you're not able to do this, the government will provide for you. This applies to all Danish people, and with this bill, it also applies to refugees coming to Denmark.
However, there is a difference here, and the difference is that these people are refugees. They are fleeing oppression of, for the most part, of one kind or another, and really cannot at least economically put themselves probably on the same economic level as citizens of Denmark.
No, but you need to understand as well that a Danish citizen, a Dane, cannot receive any cash benefits if they have in their possession assets that has a value that exceeds 10,000 Danish kroner. And that is due to this principle that we are a universal welfare state. We provide a safety net for everyone, but if you can provide for yourself, then you should. And this also applies to people coming to Denmark. What is important for me to emphasize is that the new law on seizure will only apply to what you can call non-sentimental assets, such as large amounts of cash. And it has been suggested that authorities would seize people's jewelry, people's wedding rings, and other items of obvious sentimental value. And these accusations are wrong, they are outrageous, they are false.
Tell me what the public mood is in Denmark with the influx of all of these asylum seekers.
This has, we are only 5 million people, 5.5 million people in Denmark, and we received 20,000 asylum seekers last year. So this has an impact on the local communities. This has an impact on our ability to integrate all these people in the Danish society. Therefore, we need to balance. On one side, we need to open our doors to the people running from war and running from being followed in their home countries. On the other hand, we need also to take care of Denmark. We need to ensure that we are able to receive these people. We need to ensure that we are enabled that we are able to continue having a welfare state. And therefore, we need also to not have a much higher level than the countries around us when receiving refugees.
What does this do to Denmark's reputation as a tolerant society?
I think that many of the misunderstandings regarding this bill has done some damage to the Danish brand, because we are known as an open people, as a welcoming people, and as a tolerant people, and we still are. Let me assure you of that. The issue here is we need also to take care of the country. And that means there is a limit as to how many people we can receive every year. This law on seizure, it is not something that will apply to that many people. It is more a symbol to send out to say that, listen, we have this principle for Danish people. If you can provide for yourself housing and food, then you should. And it also applies to people coming here. We will take care of the rest.
On a personal level, if I am an asylum seeker, a migrant, a refugee, or whatever, with at least tentative plans to come to Denmark, how should I take this? What is a message to them? What should they do? Should they continue to head there?
We will treat all these asylum seekers' cases, but it is also important to know that the circumstances under which you are in Denmark, you will be taken care of. But it is also expected that if you have the means, you also take part in this yourself.
Are you expecting other countries to take up the same sort of ruling?
Well, we know that regarding seizure of properties, many countries do this already. Switzerland has done this for years. Germany does it. The Netherlands have the same policy. But nobody is crying out that they are bad countries. That's how it is being on top of the world.
That's Jakob Ellemann-Jensen, a spokesman for Denmark's Liberal Party. This is VOA.
I'm Millar Sega, host of VOA's The Correspondents, a weekly roundup of the top stories with analysis from our dedicated reporters around the globe.
Among the stars expressing support, Frida Pinto.
This is a problem that inflicts almost every country.
Think of it as a conversation on the biggest issues of the day. Wherever the news may be, our correspondents are there. Listen to The Correspondents, Saturdays and Sundays on VOA.
This is International Edition. British poet Sarah Howe is the latest winner of the prestigious T.S. Eliot Prize, considered the top award for poetry in the United Kingdom. It's the first time the writer of a debut collection has won the award. Born in Hong Kong to a Chinese mother and a British father, Howe spent her early childhood in the former British colony before moving to England. Her book of poems, Loop of Jade, explores her dual heritage. The 32-year-old Howe is now on a writing fellowship at Harvard University. I asked Howe to describe her identity as a child of two cultures.
I think it's been a fascination there right from the very start of my writing life. In fact, I think it did have something to do with why I needed to write poems in the first place. I needed to grapple with those two sides of my being. And because I'd grown up in England from when I was quite small, we moved from Hong Kong when I was 7, I felt like there was always this other side of myself that I had never quite explored or got in touch with. And for me, poems became the way of doing that.
Now, your mother is Chinese. Is she from mainland China or from Hong Kong?
She was born in mainland China. So she was born in Guangdong province. We think probably in the capital city of that province, Guangzhou, though we don't really know. Her early history is a little bit blurry. The only things that she knows were told to her by her adoptive mother. And some of those details are a little bit confused or even contradictory, but we think that she was probably given up or abandoned as a baby by her natural family. And then this woman took her in, and this was all happening in 1948-49. And at that point, her adoptive Chinese mother took her across to Hong Kong Island because, well, obviously the communist revolution was kicking off exactly then. So I think they were just part of a flood of people who were moving over to Hong Kong at that point. And then she lived in Hong Kong for the rest of her life until our family upped sticks for England.
And how has that background of your mother impacted your poetry? Because your work is called Loop of Jade, which is a lovely sort of Asian atmosphere to it.
Yeah, I suppose I was a little bit wary when we were trying to think of a title for the book. My editor and I, we kept circling back to this phrase, Loop of Jade, which is the title of one of the poems. And I thought, can I possibly call a book about my Chinese heritage something that has the word jade in the title? And yet we sort of couldn't escape it because this idea was such a perfect one for what the book does. So the Loop of Jade in question is actually a baby's bracelet, which my adoptive Chinese grandmother bought for me and had blessed at the temple when I was born. And the idea is that these bracelets should be worn by toddling babies in China as a sort of protective talisman, because if the baby falls over, the idea is that the stone should smash rather than the child being hurt. And for me, I think this idea really expressed something about my line of Chinese inheritance, that I was searching for a sort of continuity with the past, but one that was inevitably broken and ruptured, because there's a point beyond which I just can't go back. I can't know anything about my sort of biological Chinese family. And I think that said something about Chinese history more widely for me too, that it's very important to Chinese cultural consciousness, this notion of sort of 3,000 years of unbroken civilization and history. And yet that unbroken civilization and history, continuous culture, is ruptured by things like the revolution of the last century and so on. So this idea of continuity and breaking was really an important one in the book.
What work are you doing now at Harvard University?
I'm working on a new sequence of poems, which I think actually the more I work on it probably wouldn't be so suited to a book so much as almost a visual art installation. And I say that because it's a more experimental piece, which is actually called an erasure poem. So the way that works is you take a source text, in my case, the basic law of Hong Kong, which is the constitution that guarantees various rights and freedoms, including the principle of one country, two systems. And the way I've been making the poem is by erasing most of the words on each page of that document until there's just a few left scattered around the frame of the page. And for me, it's been a way of exploring the upshot of the umbrella movement and all the fear that there is in Hong Kong at the moment about its political future.
Sarah Howe, the winner of Britain's T.S. Eliot Prize for Poetry. She's been a frequent visitor to Hong Kong in recent years and completed her book there. Well, that's our show. Please visit our website at voanews.com. I'm Sarah Williams. Thanks so much for joining us and have a great weekend.
Next, an editorial reflecting the views of the United States government.
The United States is concerned about the growing number of people in China recently, also including European citizens, who appear to have been coerced to confess to alleged crimes on state media, often before any trial or the announcement of any charges. Some of these people have not been afforded timely legal or consular representation, and there are also instances in which foreign nationals appear to have been brought to mainland China against their will and by extra-legal means. Recent detainees who appeared on China Central Television, or CCTV, in pre-recorded confession videos include Hong Kong-based publisher Ge Minhai of Mighty Current Media and Causeway Bay Books. Ge, a Swedish national, emerged on CCTV this month after disappearing from Thailand. Just 3 days after Ge's appearance on TV, another Swedish national, China-based human rights worker Peter Dahlin, appeared on CCTV apologizing for allegedly hurting the feelings of the Chinese people. Mr. Dahlin founded the Chinese Urgent Action Working Group to help train human rights lawyers and other activists, and was accused by the Chinese state news agency Xinhua of encouraging the masses to oppose the government. Reporters Without Borders Asia-Pacific spokesman Benjamin Ismail said his organization was outraged by the dissemination of forced confessions that have no informational value. Xinhua and CCTV, he added, represent a threat to freely produced news in the public interest. In the Reporters Without Borders Press Freedom Index, China ranks 176th out of 180 countries. Veteran Chinese journalist Gao Yu, who also appeared in a so-called confession on CCTV before being jailed for allegedly leaking state secrets overseas, later said her confession was coerced after Chinese authorities threatened her son. In 2015, she was sentenced to 7 years in prison, which was later reduced to 5 years on appeal. Due to medical reasons, she is currently serving her sentence outside of prison. Others who have been paraded before the cameras with forced confessions include Sheng Nanfu, Shen Yang Zadu, and Charles Shui. These actions, said State Department Deputy Spokesperson Mark Toner, undermine China's claim to be a rule-of-law society and run contrary to China's human rights commitments and hinder its attempts to build a more transparent and effective justice system.
That was an editorial reflecting the views of the United States government.